climate rhetoric is flaring up across the country. Minority communities are yet again becoming political tools for electoral gains. Experts say the ruling party is dividing voters on religious lines, which they say could lead to social discord in a country known as the world's largest democracy. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip have held a demonstration in support of Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Al-Quds in the face of growing Israeli aggression against the Islamic holy site. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have been on the rise in recent days in Al-Quds, with Israeli settlers backed by regime forces desecrating the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Hamas movement to organize the rally vowed to continue resistance until the liberation of all of Palestine.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is not alone, and we will protect it with our lives. The desecration of our holy site and digging tunnels under it will never give legitimacy to the Zionist enemy. The Palestinian people are in a constant state of resistance, and their resistance will continue to increase until the liberation of Al-Quds and every inch of our land.
People came out to express their support for resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks. They stressed that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine, despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
Al-Aqsa Mosque belongs to every Muslim around the world and to every Palestinian. The Zionists are creating Al-Aqsa, and we believe that only armed resistance can liberate Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque have been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
We are here to tell the whole world that Palestinians are willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. We will not remain silent amid the attacks on Al-Aqsa. Al-Quds will always be a Muslim city.
Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque have a special place in the hearts of millions of Muslims around the world due to their religious significance.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal territory say they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Grand Khatam al-Nabiyyin Mosque in Kabul was the venue for the ceremony celebrating the Prophet Muhammad's birthday and the Islamic Unity Week. The ceremony drew people from all walks of life, including religious scholars, Taliban officials, and students. The speakers emphasized the need for following the path of Prophet Muhammad in all aspects of life and strengthening the Islamic bonds.
God has introduced the Prophet of Islam as the best role model for humanity. Prophet Muhammad is the role model because he is the mercy of God for us. Following his path will bless us luck and good in the life and the hereafter.
The attendees of the ceremony also expressed their views on the occasion. Many of them said they were happy to see Muslims from different sects coming together and celebrating their common faith. They also said they hoped for peace and stability in their war-torn country.
Western countries have always tried to divide Muslims. This has been one of their plots to implement their goals and dominate Muslim territories. But fortunately, today, all our Muslim brothers are aware and won't let anyone divide us or create hatred among us. We should work together for the prosperity and security of our Islamic world.
The Islamic Unity Week is an annual event that is observed by both Sunni and Shia Muslims around the world. This is also an opportunity for Muslims to celebrate their common values. Following decades of invasion and war in their country, Afghan Muslims have gathered today to show their unity and brotherhood. They also voice support for other Muslims across the world in the face of global arrogance and oppression. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Muslim Motivated by a consistent campaign of the late anti-apartheid leader and former Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Anglican Church has now resolved to officially classify Israel an apartheid regime. It aligns with a decision by the South African Council of Churches, which has long been critical of the Zionist regime and its oppressive doctrine. The Archbishop of the Anglican Church, Reverend Thabo Makgoba, who is currently at the Vatican, said in an audio message that remaining silent on the continued oppression of the Palestinian people cannot be tolerated.
Our hearts ache for our Christian brothers and sisters in Palestine, whose numbers include Anglicans but are rapidly declining. People of all faiths in South Africa have both a deep understanding of what it is to live under oppression, as well as experience of how to confront and overcome unjust rule.
In its resolution, the Church goes to lengths to underscore that solidarity visits must be carried out to Palestine, and particular efforts must be made to engage with the Church in Al-Quds and ordinary Palestinian Christians to learn the true extent of their suffering under Israeli occupation. It acknowledges that until now, when Christians do visit Al-Quds, they often overlook the Palestinian reality, and in some instances are even taken on all-expenses-paid propaganda trips by the Zionist regime.
The fact that it's the birthplace of Jesus Christ, I think the question of language is very important, and the statement makes point of when pilgrimages are conducted from us as South Africans to Jerusalem, then the fact of the name of Palestine or Palestine is never mentioned. It's always Israel, and yet in Jesus' day, it would have been Palestine.
While the Anglican Church has taken steps to talk about Palestine, it hopes the resolution identifying Israel as an apartheid regime will overcome the apathy which it says still prevails within the Christian community. The Anglican Church's decision comes ahead of an international conference on apartheid Israel in South Africa later this year. The Dutch Reformed Church is also expected to take a similar decision later this month, further emphasizing the plight of the Palestinian people. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
Suicide bomber from the Daesh terrorist group detonated his explosives last year, turning the large classroom of the college education center into a bloodbath. 57 people died and more than 100 others were injured, mostly female students. 1 year on, the families and friends of the victims have gathered here to remember their lost loved ones and share their stories of grief and anguish. They are still mourning and suffering from the consequences of that tragic day.
Last year, on this day, I lost my beloved classmates forever and witnessed their dead bodies fallen on the floor. This whole year, I lived with the memory I had made with them and the tragedy of their martyrdom. I was wondering how to live with the pain of our lost dreams and hopes. Every second, I missed them, and this whole year was as devastating as hell.
The families of the victims say they have not received any justice for their loss. They urge the Taliban government to bring the perpetrators to justice and to provide a safe environment for Shia Hazaras to exercise their rights.
I call on the de facto government to bring to justice and punish the terrorists who killed our daughters at educational centers. Our students are the assets of the Afghan nation and should not be ignored. All Afghans have rights, including the right to peaceful education. This right should never be denied or stolen from us.
The attack also left many survivors, like Shahrbanu, with physical and psychological injuries. They are still undergoing treatment and therapy, hoping to resume their normal life and education.
After I was discharged from hospital, my physical injuries slightly healed, but my psychological wounds didn't. Since then, I've been depressed and shocked. I can't socialize or go out with friends. I'm seeing a therapist, and I hope this will help me get back to my normal life and continue my education.
The Shia Hazara community, which has faced decades of discrimination and persecution in Afghanistan, has been repeatedly targeted by Daesh and other extremist groups in recent years. Today, they want justice, peace, and security. This is a day of remembrance and solidarity for the victims and also families of the Koj Educational Center attack. This is also a day of defiance and determination for the Shia Hazara people who refuse to give in to terror and hatred. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The 9th Science and Technology Exchange Program, or STEP, is being held alongside the 5th Mustafa Prize Award Ceremony in Isfahan. The event started on September 30th and will run for 3 days. STEP is a platform that intends to expand the scientific network across the Islamic world in the form of holding international events, while also laying the groundwork to enhance scientific synergy and cooperation.
In each round of the Mustafa Prize, in addition to the award ceremony, as we host lots of eminent scientists from different Islamic countries, in addition to the ceremony, we also organize some programs in various scientific centers to share with each other the recent achievements we have had. I mean the participating scientists and technologists will share their achievements with us and with other participants and share their experiences, their success story and also their failure. And it helps us to make synergy and to help each other in developing science and technology in the Islamic countries.
Heads of universities and research centers, policymakers, as well as eminent scientists of the Islamic world have participated in this event. The 9th edition of the event comprises of different panels on several topics such as ecosystem, artificial intelligence and medical sciences.
Today was one part of the whole conference that focused on precision medicine and a number of diseases, among them malignancies, allergic and immunological diseases. Basically, it showed the benefit of, instead of grouping all patients with a specific disease and treat them all similarly, which may result into either poor benefits or no benefits, or sometimes even side effects of medication. So the idea is, you know, to reach the better prognosis, better outcome for the group of patients with the same disease, that we should divide them into subgroups.
Some keynote speakers said the event can achieve much more than just collaboration among scientists in the Muslim world.
So this is a great event that can not only foster collaboration and also scientific ideas, but also will continue to lead to better research in the future.
The past 8 STEP events were hosted by universities and research centers in Iran, Malaysia, Oman, and Pakistan.
Presence of top Muslim scholars in this year's event creates a perfect platform for the exchange of information with Iranian scientists and researchers. Mahdi Abbasian, Isfahan.
Muslim political leaders and scholars chanting anti-US and anti-Israel slogans during the Islamic Unity Conference in Islamabad. Key Shia and Sunni clerics and thinkers took part in the event to share their thoughts and viewpoints on the issues of the Muslim world. They urged the Islamic governments, academics, and scientists to present a single charter that outlines the Muslim nation solidarity in various sectors.
Imam Khomeini announced the Unity Week in order to bridge differences in the Muslim community and strengthen solidarity among its members. Enemies are plotting to divide Muslims, so the unity of the Muslim Ummah is the key to success.
This year's conference comes just days after terrorists attacked 2 religious gatherings in countries' northern and southwestern provinces, leaving over 55 people dead and many others wounded. The participants urged the Muslim community to stand up to terrorist groups and insisted that corruption, poverty, and terrorism should be eradicated from the Muslim world.
Suicide attacks, sectarian division, and terrorism are haram or forbidden in Islam. It's time that all of us stay united to root out such menaces from the country.
The principles and actions of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, provided a strong foundation for Muslims' unity during his time. The life of the Prophet Muhammad is a great source of guidance for Muslims.
The conference is the climax of the Islamic Unity Week that marks the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad.
The unity achieved under the guidance of Prophet Muhammad left a lasting legacy that will not only continue to inspire Muslims to work hard for their harmony, but also provide a strong foundation for Muslims striving for unison, tolerance, and social justice in the modern era. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
In the limelight.
Hatem Abu Sharia is a Palestinian photographer who was attacked by Zionist regime forces while doing his job. Hatem was also placed in solitary confinement. His conditions were extremely cramped. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Electronic Intifada wrote, Hatem Abu Sharia is a photographer who was attacked while doing his job. On May 28, 2018, Hatem was covering the Great March of Return, regular protests called to demand respect for basic Palestinian rights. Accompanied by a fellow photographer, he was close to Gaza's boundary with the occupied territories when Zionist regime snipers began firing towards them. Hatem and his colleague managed to find a hiding place where they could avoid the snipers' bullets. While they were spared death, the two men were soon found by the Zionist regime troops. The troops captured both men and took them to the boundary. Hatem said, "They made us take off all our clothes. They kept hitting us until my glasses were broken." Hatem and his colleague were handcuffed and driven to Erez, an Israeli regime military checkpoint. Hatem said, "Even on the road, the Israeli troops kept beating us." That evening, the two men were taken to a prison in Ashkelon. When they arrived, the prison's administrators claimed it was too late for them to enter. They had to spend the night outdoors, with the Zionist regime personnel watching over them. Hatem said, "We were handcuffed and we were blindfolded." As it was Ramadan, the two men had been fasting all day. They were not offered anything to eat or drink by their captors that evening. The following morning, the two men were brought into the prison. It was the beginning of a lengthy period during which Hatem was subjected to extreme violence, both overtly physical and psychological. He said, "In almost every interrogation, they beat and tortured me." Hatem was placed in solitary confinement. His conditions were extremely cramped. He said, "Sometimes they put me in a cell that was just 1.5 meters long. I am 1.95 meters tall." Hatem was eventually put on trial in May 2019, a year after his arrest. He was charged with entering the occupied territories unlawfully and photographing military facilities without authorization. He was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. The sentence included the year he spent in pretrial detention. When he heard of his sentence, he said, "I felt like I wanted to cry, but I didn't want to break down in front of Israeli regime authorities." During the trial, Hatem was kept in Nafha prison. The conditions there were a little better than in Ascalon. He said, "I found people to speak with. I could cut my hair and take a shower after spending 53 days without bathing." Many other prisoners who he met had been handed sentences of 20 or 30 years. Knowing that his own sentence was shorter eased things slightly. Hatem was held in Eshel, a prison in the city of Beersheba, but later transferred to Ketziot, which is located in the Negev region. He was not given any reason for the transfer. He said, "Your name suddenly comes up for transfer. They move you on a whim. You've built up friendships and suddenly you are with new people. They didn't like seeing us happy." Hatem found ways of defying his jailers. Using smuggled mobile phones, he applied to sit the Taujihi, an exam taken before going to university. The Zionist regime does not allow textbooks into prisons. To challenge that ban, Hatem had the school books smuggled to him. The book covers and initial 10 pages were altered so that the prison authorities would think that they belong to the categories of permitted reading material. Many other prisoners also sat the exams. As the number of textbooks were available, they developed a system whereby each prisoner would have a book for a week and then hand it over to others. Exam papers are also not allowed, so one prisoner would have to communicate with a particular school, find out the exam questions, and then circulate them among other prisoners. Being able to overcome obstacles created a sense of camaraderie among the prisoners. When Hatem learned he had passed the exam, an impromptu party ensued. Hearing prisoners break into song, the prison authorities demanded to know why so much noise was coming from the cells. Hatem said they didn't like seeing us happy. Hatem's mother, Feiga, sought permission via the International Committee of the Red Cross to visit him on numerous occasions. All her requests were turned down. First, the Zionist regime cited security as a pretext. Later, it invoked restrictions introduced amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Following the death of his father in 2015, Hatem's bonds with his mother became increasingly strong. Feiga said, "Hatem was my right-hand man. When he was imprisoned, I felt like I had lost him." The early stages of Hatem's detention were especially difficult. With almost no information available to her, Feiga was uncertain that he was alive until he called her one day with a mobile phone smuggled into prison. Eventually, Hatem was released in May this year. Feiga said, "I shed tears of joy when I could hug him again. The feeling was indescribable." Now aged 28, Hatem is trying to rebuild his life. He has just become engaged. Numerous photographers and reporters were attacked during the Great March of Return by the Zionist regime forces. The Zionist regime killed two photojournalists, Yasser Mortaja and Ahmad Abu Hussein, while they were covering those protests. 9 other media workers were wounded. The Zionist regime's attacks on the press have continued since then. Such attacks caught the attention of the world's media last year when Israeli regime forces killed Shirin Abu Aghele, a journalist with Al Jazeera, in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. While Abu Aghele's killing prompted expressions of concern, so far toothless, from the United States, where she held citizenship, and the European Union, most violence against Palestinian media workers elicits no response from powerful governments. Hatem Abu Sharia is among many whose plight has been ignored.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And now, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, spoke on the birth anniversary of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. He reiterated how important unity among Muslims can be and how far it can go to wipe out apartheid in Palestine, looting in North Africa, and hegemony and bullying in West Asia. And on the flip side, the Iranian leader emphasized how far normalizing ties with the Israeli regime and allowing the U.S. into the region sets Muslims back and apart. Today, we'll bring the Iranian leader's comments under the spotlight. Now joining us is Saeed Shath, author and West Asia expert, joining us out of Belfast. And Mr. Shabir Razvi, political analyst, joining us from London.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there with you, Mr. Shabir Razvi, a political analyst joining us there out of London. Now, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said normalizing ties with the Israeli regime today is like betting on a dead horse. What do you make of that assertion?
Thank you for the invitation. Look, I think the metaphor used by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran is quite apt. but, you know, coming from UK, I would use another metaphor, if you like. You know, Israel is not losing wicket. It's a cricket game that's played in the UK. Many of your listeners may not be aware of it, but a losing wicket is when the team is likely not to win the game. And I think that's the situation at this moment for the Zionist entity. It is becoming abundantly clear over the last 8 decades that the regime has been in existence, that progressively it is journeying towards its own destruction, not by any sort of external forces as such, but there is huge amount of dissension within the borders of the illegitimate entity that was created way back in 1948. And the situation has become difficult for it to survive. And you've got to really understand that, firstly, it gets huge amount of support from the US and the collective West, not just sort of supporting it politically and diplomatically, but also financially. Billions and billions of dollars are sent in aid to the Zionist entity. Secondly, many businesses also invest in this particular regime. Your IT sector has huge sort of, you know, whether it's Google, Microsoft, Amazon, you name it, and the sort of new AI and IT security industries, they you invest hugely in this particular sort of part of the world. Therefore, it gets support. And when people say that, you know, the Zionist entity created a sort of a garden out of a desert, if they're getting this kind of money in aid and support and also through sort of financial sectors, you can imagine what would happen if only a minuscule of that was given to the developing world. In Africa, in South America, and other parts of the world, one would see poverty being reduced in a couple of decades very easily, while Israel, the Zionist entity, benefits from all levels. But people, you know, the citizens of that nation, come from Russia or Ukraine or Eastern Europe, this sort of the Zionist entity as a to USA, or because they realize the danger that they are facing on a daily basis. Although the Israeli forces killed the Palestinians willy-nilly, but the pressure on the citizens of this illegitimate regime is becoming acute daily.
Thank you, Mr. Razvi. Mr. Saeb Shaf, thanks for your patience. Welcome to the program, sir. And now, another thing the Iranian leader said, he said that the days of the Israeli regime are numbered. And he said this on more than one occasion, and he said it more than one occasion today in his remarks. And also, Mr. Razvi just said that it's taking steps toward its own destruction. Is that too optimistic, or do you agree with that?
Let me put it this way. I didn't put the external or factors of the Zionist project in the right maybe path. I see if we look at the Zionist entity project, it was planned for it to have what they call it the Greater Israel from Euphrates to Nile. And this project, it was even after the great success of 1967 war, which was led actually, and it's brought by American airstrikes tagged on it like the David Stark to look like it's in a Zionist entity airplanes, which defeated Syria, Jordan, Palestine, and Egypt, I mean. But after that, straight away after the war, in 1967 itself, the Egyptian army destroyed the major Eilat spying ship in there, which was, they thought the Zionists, they never, ever, Egypt or Syria will recover from such a defeat. 68, the Egyptian they started the retaliation war against Israel. And it took them up to 1973 when they waged, along with Syria, a war which massively defeated the Zionist entity. And if we look at the Palestinian resistance itself, in 1968, they directed the PLO a massive blow at an encouraging Israeli brigades in Karama village in Jordan, and they destroyed them. They acknowledged that. In 2000, you look at Lebanon, the Lebanese resistance led by Hezbollah defeated them and pushed them out of Lebanon, liberating the south. In 2006, the same they did. And the Palestinian resistance in 2005 defeated them out of Gaza and chased them out with their settlers. So this project, in a speedy reverse, is retracting its own massive empire which is supposed to be created. And it lives in there by support of the United States of America, as your guest alluded to, and the West. West taxpayers' money and the United States of America, who is ensuring that Zionist entity existence, since it is an extension to neocolonialism of the Western imperialism. And that project will be defeated. The Palestinian resistance is getting strong. And if we look at the Arab and Islamic resistance, take it from Yemen to Iraq, to Syria, to Lebanon, to Palestine, they are strong. They couldn't defeat Syria after this massive takfiri war, which led by the United States of America, and Syria still standing. The same thing if you look at Yemen. Yemen is stopped the aggression, which is the Saudis, the face of it, but actually American aggression, and stopped from the U.S. of controlling that strategic area, so to dominate the whole region. I can go for more and more and more, but I want to give you and your guest more time.
Thank you, Mr. Saib Shah. Now, Mr. Razvi, Mr. Shah touched on this, and I want you to, if you could elaborate on it, because Ayatollah Khamenei also said that the regime just doesn't have animosity towards Iran, but all of its neighbors, and I want to go one step further and say possibly every Muslim country in the region. Does the regime in Tel Aviv care or not have disdain for any Islamic country, in your point of view?
Look, that obviously is one of the key aspects, but a colonial power, an imperial power, a racist power, an apartheid regime does not really care for whether they're Muslims or non-Muslims. As you can see, when people are killed, murdered, and assassinated, it's not only Muslims, but also Christians living in the occupied territories, as we saw with the Al Jazeera journalist who was reporting while she was filing her report, was assassinated by the Israeli offensive force. I call it Israeli offensive force rather than IDF, because that's what they are. They're not there for defending the nation, but for being offensive and for killing. So, and also we saw that at her burial, the sort of shenanigans, the Israeli forces at that time creating a commotion at the funeral of this Al Jazeera journalist. And on a daily basis, the Christians are also being killed. And we have seen historically that it's not only Muslims who have been at the forefront to fight the Zionist entity, but they have been Christians, they have been, Orthodox Christians. Historically, there was one patriarch. His name sort of escapes my mind at this moment. But 30 years ago, he was intermediary to bring arms from Lebanon to the occupied territories. So this particular entity doesn't care whether they're Muslims or followers of any other faith. They just want to be there to occupy a part of West Asia so that the colonial regime that was created by the Balfour Act in UK and supported by the US and the collective West, wants to continuously control West Asia and the Muslim countries, and through that, the wider region, if you like.
And that's ironic, Mr. Sahib Shath, because just like Mr. Razvi, the Iranian leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also spoke a lot about unity and said that the colonial Western powers, they engineer their policies for West Asia to keep this discord, to keep this disunity among Muslims. Could you imagine a united front that could be a tool against apartheid in Palestine, against looting of natural resources in North Africa, against Syria having its oil taken right in broad daylight from it and taken over to Iraq and then sent to whoever knows where in the world? Could you imagine how many problems in the region and North Africa among Muslim countries and other Arab leaders could be resolved if there is some unity?
Of course. I want to just say the name that for which is my friend tried to say that Archbishop Kabuchi, who was alluding to. What's called the founder of the Zionist entity, Ben-Gurion, have a doctrine, and that doctrine, which is most of the Zionist leadership today and the army adheres to, and it's centered around creating fictions in the region, creating states fighting each other, and disunity, and putting the whole area in disarray through intelligence, disinformation, using the Western media and using all the tools available, plus using their army to be able to fight in double or treble fronts. This is their doctrine, how to, or, and of course, the reason for creating such an entity in the region was, first of all, located in Palestine. Palestine is, means separating the North African side from the Arabic Islamic world and the Asian one. It's like a wedge in the heart of the Arab Islamic world. And then it's to go there to be the thug who guarantees the transportation, the strategic waterways, and the energy and all the resources in the area. Because Western empires learned historically, if you don't control, especially the Levant, a plus side of Egypt in there, you cannot control or hegemonize the whole world. And this is where the Western always focus in controlling that area. And plus, they think there is, after the Islamic Revolution of Iran 1979, they lost their milking cow from, and they wanted it back. That's why they are always active in trying to create disorder, to send their spies to destabilize the regime in there and do a regime a change as they try all this, so they can bring in Iran, under auspices of what they call it, United Nations or democracies, a kind of regime which will serve as their own milking cow. And the same thing goes for the Saudis, the same thing goes for the Gulf states. All these states, especially in the Gulf, Saudis and United Arab Emirates and the rest of them, were engineered before the Sykes-Picot plans appeared to be as part of the whole area, which is they designed. So they know once they created Israel, they created so many sides to the Zionist entity in there. They call it the Arab Zionist as well, who they wanted to engineer regimes to adhere to the Zionist policies so they can protect this Zionist entity when it was in its infancy at the start. Now the Zionist entity have to pay in protecting this area and these regimes. And here we can see why the Bush of the was the United States of America during Trump and after and even before, in what they call it, normalizing relationship with the Zionist entity. There was never been a relationship with them to normalize to start with, which means the acknowledgement of these states of the de facto Zionist control of that area. and they want to make sure it's legitimate. But that can fly in the face of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia started, you know, didn't mind the Emirates or Bahrain, which they actually obeyed to the Saudis' order to normalize the relationship with the Zionist entity. They didn't mind Morocco or Algeria or Jordan as well. So they want to do a further step now to say themselves to normalize maybe relationship, but with the Zionist entity, because this is the American pressures on them. So it is trying to tell us, in a way, they're doing this just to avoid some of the pressures from Biden's administration till the election go away, and then they are not going to be a normalizing relationship. But I think the Saudis are shrewder than that. They are going toward the normalization, and their project in the controlling the regions, I think it's part of the American and Israeli's control.
Thank you, Mr. Saeed-Shaw. Mr. Razi, thanks for your patience. And now back to you, Mr. Razi. Why is it that some Arab leaders simply do not see the benefits of uniting with other Muslim leaders to stand against Western, especially U.S. hegemony in the region?
Well, look, sometimes some leaders and individuals act in a manner very short term, thinking that it would be in their interest. But they have to really understand that the source of destruction in that region and globally is Zionism. The fountain of terrorism is Zionism. Humanity really ceased to exist when Israel was established. History's stain will be removed when Zionism is abolished. What I think the leadership in that part of the world is thinking, that having a detente, a relationship with the Zionist entity may sort of secure their own positions for many, many, many decades to come. But what we have seen in the recent past is that even a leader like Saddam, who was supported by the West to inflict an 8-year war on the Islamic Republic of Iran and to sort of eliminate the Islamic Republic from the world in its early stages, when time came, even he was abandoned. And we've seen that on and on and on in many, many parts of the world, that those leaders who have felt that having the support of the U.S. And to sort of have relationship by force with Israel, America is not really a best partner for them to have. It's not a partner that is reliable. It's not a partner that will support them when the chips are down. It will actually abandon them. So I think if they evaluate their own positions, as Iran has quite often said, that region's security should be managed by the nations of that particular region, not by Washington, Paris, or London, using the Zionist entity to sell the concept that their security is dependent on having a so-called normalization of relationship with Tel Aviv. I think, as I said, it's a very short-term approach that the leaders are taking. If they evaluate with cool minds, they will realize that it is not in their interest to go on that route. The journey for establishing or normalization of relationship with the Zionist entity could actually prove to be destructive for themselves.
Okay, we don't have much time left, and I actually want to change gears for the last couple of minutes and put this question to both of you. Mr. Saeed-Shaw out of Belfast, the Iranian leader also said, don't be so naive to think that recent acts of desecration of the Holy Quran are isolated incidents. We saw it in the Netherlands. We saw it in Sweden. We saw it in Denmark over just a very short period, a few months apart. Yet, and they're all supported by authorities and security services for it to be carried out. The Iranian leader says these are not isolated incidents. There are people planning behind the scenes for this exact thing to happen. It's not going to compromise the value of the Holy Book, but we have to be wary of who is doing it and why.
This is a very good question. I want to link it from this angle. If you look, when the Americans occupied Iraq 2003, the population of the Christians in Iraq shrank to less than 10% what it used to be. Very few Christians left in the north of Iraq today. And the same thing in Syria when they attacked the town of Ma'loula, which is the holy site of the Christianity after Bethlehem in the Middle East, as well Syrian Christians being pushed, and all of that by Takfiri forces as well. If you look in the Arab world, Christians are being pushed away from their natural homeland, which is in Palestine. There is a few Christians left, and the Zionist entity do its best to encourage their immigration out of Palestine. I believe myself as well, you can see the targeting of Islam and Islamophobia and targeting of the Islamic values all over, and they want to make it look like it's reactionary. While Islam is the most progressive religion, they want to make the Muslim women who want to wear abba or hijab as a woman who has been dictated to or enslaved, while Islam came to liberate such a woman. They ignore all of these facts, but in the Arab world and in South Asia, they want to make sure there is no Christians left, and only divide between Shia Muslim and Sunni Muslim fighting each other. And in the future, if they attack any country, they can tell the West, and we are attacking these thugs Muslims. There is no Christians in there, so they cannot have a backlash from their own population.
We have about 1 minute left. Mr. Razvi, I really want to put this to you. Desecration, who's behind it and why?
Well, look, it's a long topic, and I'll try to sort of give you some bullet points. At the end of the day, as our colleague from Belfast was saying, that there's a whole Islamophobia industry that is active through the so-called think tanks, but I call them junk tanks, really, because at the end of the day, the whole purpose is to ignite fear in the population of the indigenous population living in the West. But the reality is that as this is the week of unity, as designated by Imam Khomeini, and it has of founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, that this is the week in which we celebrate the anniversary of the most incredible individual that was sent to mankind as a mercy. And that mercy, if that message, because what happens in the West is the more there is propaganda against Islam and the Prophet of Islam, people want to know what this particular religion is. We saw that soon after the Twin Towers incident and other issues, whenever Islam is targeted, people want to read more about it. And there are more people who become Muslim because by default, what is happening is that the more anti-Islam and anti-Muslim propaganda is perpetrated on the population, the thinking people want to really understand what this particular religion is, and they come to the religion themselves. Okay. So what I say that bring on more Islam.